And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast. This is being recorded on Wednesday afternoon. So if crazy things happen on Wednesday that invalidate anything that we talk about, well, don't blame me. Just blame the events of Wednesday. And to talk about the top of the East and many other things, I'm thrilled to be joined by New York's own Dan Devine of The Ringer. How you doing?
I'm doing really well, Zach. Thanks so much for having me back.
They're treating you all right over there?
They're doing okay, yeah. I know a lot of mutual friends, and they've been very kind.
Bill was very excited about that Celtics win last night.
He really, really was. I think Ringer Slack might be one of the most discussed things in podcasting at this point, but it was a vibrant time last night and this morning.
Well, because Ryan's a Philly fan.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? Any other Philly fans on there? Or Gonzalez?
It's Gons, yeah. It's a pretty sick stack of Sixers fans and Philly fans. So it gets heavy in there. It gets thick.
So that's what I wanted to use this Celtics-Sixers game as an excuse to talk about what I think is the most interesting question in the league right now, which is the top of the East. And we still have to include the Pacers, I think, who have won six in a row.
Yep,
that's not a typo. Six in a row.
Yeah, they lost four in a row after Oladipo went down, and then they've ripped off six.
Now, look, I don't think they have the juice really, but Nate McMillan has to be in the Coach of the Year conversation, and I think maybe I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit because his footwork can still get a little out of whack. I think Miles Turner is close to being in the Defensive Player of the Year conversation. Is that crazy to you? I think he might belong in it.
Yeah, I don't think so at all. I think people have written about that sort of. He really started to come into his own a little bit, maybe like December, as the second quarter of the season was kind of coming on. And, you know, just the ability to shut down the front of the rim for a few minutes at a time, basically. You know, he doesn't get thrown off as much he doesn't get thrown off the scent as much as he used to. And then he's just huge and he can move around and he makes everything hard for those guys. They've had a softer run of the last couple of weeks. I think the schedule turned for them at a good time. But, the fact that they've continued to be in that 3-4 mix, even after Oladipo went down and even after
really impressive
the other teams have sort of loaded up, is pretty incredibly impressive. And I agree with you. Nate McMillan's going to get a lot of consideration there.
Miles Turner is shooting now up to 41% from three. He's shooting more lately. He'll shoot contested threes over smaller guys when they veer back out to him on the pick and roll, which I like, instead of shooting his 22-footers. No one has really strangled the Defensive Player of the Year award. Kawhi isn't quite the same. Draymond has been, actually, I think Draymond's season has probably been underrated defensively. Maybe he ends up winning it. Maybe Gobert ends up repeating because that's kind of like Gobert should win.
Right.
Embiid, the same guys as usual, but I think Miles Turner's in that group.
Do you think George gets a little look given sort of like the rising?
Oh, I forgot about him. Yeah, I just did a whole podcast about Paul George. Yes, Paul George might be the favorite right now. Paul George might be the favorite. He is in the MVP race. He's not in the ballot spot race anymore. He's right in the race.
Yeah, we've moved. It's like now the capital C conversation. It's not just the fringes thereof.
Whatever supersedes conversation. Right. He's in the debate for MVP, but I don't want to talk about that. So Indiana, okay, so maybe they hang in. Maybe they're more of a threat than we're giving them credit for. That's possibly true. Everyone is focused on the four high wattage teams, Boston, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, and Toronto. Whew. And boy, it's the most popular parlor game question I get. Who would you pick to come out of the East? I was texting with a couple GMs yesterday. Who'd you pick? And just when you worry about Boston, and just last Friday on this podcast with Bobby Marks, I said, if I were a Boston fan, I'd be really worried about that second round. We can get into why. Obviously, it's been a strange season for Boston. They come out without Kyrie and beat the Sixers again on the road again. And Al Horford again, is just a complete nightmare for Joel Embiid on both ends of the floor. They guard Simmons pretty well again. And despite the new starting five and all that, Boston comes out with another win. And I think I thought this Boston team had a chance to be special. I said 60 win special. That's obviously was wrong. That was stupid. That was a bad prediction. Wrong. And I think I underestimated A, the chemistry issues which have clearly plagued them, and B, how long it would take Hayward to be Hayward. Now, I don't think that Hayward is Hayward yet, but the last month has been very encouraging. Last night was very encouraging. And if they get to May and Hayward is 90% of Hayward, and that Horford is the Horford that we see every game, and Kyrie is back and the chemistry is a little better, they're a problem again. And then I'm just like, I got no idea. Are you leaning to any of these teams?
I mean, I think it's weird because the Celtics have been a trick-or-treat team for so much of the year. You know, these stretches of 500 ball bracketed by stretches of like them winning 10 out of 11. But they're also maybe the most known quantity out of everything that we see in the top of these just because of the big changes that those other teams have made. I'm really interested to see how Nikola Mirotic winds up sort of factoring in Milwaukee. He's to some degree almost like surplus to requirements. They don't need him to play the style they want to play. They might need him to play the style they want to play for 48 minutes against really good teams. But there, I think the way he can fit into that, into Coach Bud's system and maybe give them a matchup proofing option against teams that want to go a little smaller, I think that's a really big question, but it's going to take some time for them to figure that out. Gasol, obviously, in Toronto, like they're passing the ball so much more.
Has gone better than I mean, look, I love Marc Gasol. Everybody knows I love Marc Gasol. Everybody, the five people who listen to this podcast know that I really love Marc Gasol. It's gone smoother than I thought. I bet that they'll experiment with starting him at some point. I don't know that this is a permanent thing where he's going to come off the bench. But that, I haven't trusted the vibe around that team all season. Mm-hmm. I just haven't. There's a strange feeling emanating out of there. Kyle Lowry's play has been weird. The last 2 weeks have been better, but like these weirdly passive games, and it's the back issues and the rumblings that they at least took a phone call with Memphis. I'm comfortable. I think that happened. I'm not sure it was an enthusiastic phone call, but they took the call and it got back to him. It was reported. It got back to him. I don't think he was happy about that. The vibes just aren't, it's just something's off. But Gasol is a vibe changer. When he's not cranky about the coach, right, he's a vibe changer. And the way he can add a little bit of creativity to their offense when the game slows down, a fail-safe, like a little comfort blanket you throw the ball to, and all of a sudden you have these guys that are good cutters. Like Siakam looks like a dynamite cutter. Anunoby all of a sudden looks like a dynamite cutter. All of a sudden those guys are like invigorated. Mm-hmm. And things start snapping a little bit. There's the Toronto offense, and then there's the Kawhi offense.
Right.
All of a sudden, you have someone who can bridge those gaps a little bit. Again, he's played two games. But the fit's more intriguing already than I thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, and I think you have to be encouraged by the fact that in those two games, Kawhi also, I think, put up season high in assists in both games. And so, like, if that helps bridge that gap between Kawhi knowing, like, whenever I need to, I can just go create the space and get my own, and brings him more into the fold there. If that's the bridge to sort of figuring out what the best version of Toronto's overall offense is, that's obviously a huge win. I think we both like Valanciunas as a player more than maybe some other people, but there's just no question about the upgrade that you get in the rotation with what Marc Gasol can do. The question is just going to be, you know, how does Nick Nurse continue to manage that by committee starting lineup rotation, or, you know, what lineups can Gasol play against defensively when those other teams at the top of the East decide they're going to start going small and spreading people out? And what's their version of the answer for that with Marc Gasol, and is he cool with that in the playoffs?
Well, and I think Horford last night reminded you, he's had these knee issues. Movement kind of hasn't been the same. I thought he moved great last night. He reminded you, I can be a problem. Mm-hmm. For Brooke Lopez, for Joel Embiid, for Marc Gasol, I can be a problem. You cannot drop back into pick and roll against me. And we saw this in the playoffs last year. It's one of my, you know, as the years go by, you just have these things that stick out from playoff seasons, right? You forget some of the specifics here or there, but there are things that never get out of your mind. And one of them will be that the Philadelphia 76ers had to hide Joel Embiid on Marcus Morris last year.
Yeah.
Because he could not guard Al Horford. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget being in the arena in Philly, or maybe it was in Boston. I don't remember where it was where they finally did it.
I'll never forget. I'm not sure where.
Yeah, at some gym somewhere where they sitting there thinking, wow, they're actually, I mean, what a moment for Joel Embiid. Hey, buddy, you might win Defensive Player of the Year. We got to find an easier job for you. You can't do this job. It's above your pay grade. You can't do it. And that happened again last night. You drop back, he hits threes. You switch, he works pumps and goes off the dribble. And all of a sudden, and like posting up, I looked at the numbers. Last year, Joel Embiid posting up against Al Horford was like 0.75 points per possession. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. Something about Al's timing, strength and the way Boston sends help at the right times. You just can't figure it out.
And that, I mean, all the things that we were hearing about and that looked really real in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia lineup over those first two games after the Tobias Harris trade, that doesn't solve this. Because if you do that again, you hide Embiid on Marcus Morris. I mean, do you trust Tobias Harris to hold up against Al Horford? You know,
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, but the way that Marcus Morris kind of stole Tobias Harris's lunch money in the first half of that game too was sort of like, I don't know. Yeah, I think I wrote about that at The Ringer a little bit on Wednesday, that idea that this was almost like a game six of that series, it felt like. So many of the pieces have changed and the names on the backs of the jerseys have changed, but, you know, I don't know if it's like Furkan Korkmaz playing the role of Marco Bellinelli getting torched or, you know, Tobias Harris at some points in that game being like a Robert Covington tribute band.
Ooh.
I love both of those players, but in that matchup, that was a problem. And, you know, if Tobias Harris is going to be going 4-for-14 and missing all six of his threes in those matchups, it's not going to solve the problems that Philly needs to have solved.
Well, we need to just learn, like, you just can't go crazy over these things after two games. They beat the Nuggets.
No way. Hard takes. Hot takes, Zach.
It's true. It's what the people want. And
it's why you and I are so good at that.
They beat Denver. Was Denver on the second end of a back-to-back? If not, they were clearly banged up and missing. Mm-hmm. Not, I mean, their bench has been unbelievable.
Maybe they've just been dying. They've been dying for the All-Star break, Denver, it felt like.
And then they played the Lakers, who are going through some stuff, going through some things at home, and they beat the Lakers, who subsequently lost to the Hawks last night. I mean, no great shame losing to the Hawks. I'm just saying, if you're trying to make the playoffs, you probably beat the Hawks. The Nuggets were not on a back-to-back. They just weren't like amazing wins.
Right.
But I do really like that lineup. I really do.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot to like.
I think that's a really good lineup. And when you start stacking them up player for player, it's scared. Like, I wish Kyrie had played last night. If only, like, so who's he guarding? JJ? I think that's the only answer. Now, they chanced a lot of possessions with Rozier on Jimmy Butler. I don't think I'm not sure you can do that with Kyrie. Or maybe if you, and then there's the flip side of like, well, who's guarding Kyrie?
Right.
And I think that's what's interesting about Tobias Harris has solved their problem. Like, who's guarding power forwards every night? Tobias Harris is going to do it. That lets them throw Ben Simmons around the court in different ways. And I actually think he might be their best defender of point guards among that starting five. I think he might be of good point guards. Like, JJ Redick, I don't think you want to put JJ on Kyrie Irving. Don't think you want to put him on Kyle Lowry.
Right.
Simmons can do that job in very, very, he might be the best. I just think that starting lineup scares me.
I don't disagree with you. I wonder though, and this is sort of it's a conversation I've had with a couple of people. If Elton Brand goes back in that conversation with the Clippers and says like, all right, we're giving you all these draft assets. We're giving you the Landry Shamet. We're doing all this. We need Patrick Beverley back in the deal too, and we need that as like a sort of second option security blanket for guarding those kinds of guys. Do you think that is a deal breaker at that point, given what the Clippers' goals were, or do you think that was something that really would have meaningfully moved the needle for Philly?
I think so. Reconstructing trades is like my least favorite part of the job at this point. I hate it. I hate it. I do think the Miami pick was the most important thing that the Clippers wanted in that trade. I think it's hard to tell when they got over that goal line.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Sixers gave up one too many things. Now, is the one too many things not getting Patrick Beverley or something like that versus, you know, maybe their own, they could have kept their own pick.
Right.
I think they gave up one too many things, but I respect what they've done in that they have correctly assessed their roster and said, Ben and Joel are good enough now. Mm-hmm. Now, they have warts in their game. Simmons has a giant wart, the biggest wart of all warts in his game. But they're ready to win now. They're good enough to win big now.
Right.
If we get them a little more talent that fits better. And Tobias Harris, I think he's a good fit. I think he fits pretty well. You've seen, there was a possession last night in the third quarter, where Redick took his little handoff from Joel Embiid on the left side, like they do 50 times a game, and it just destroys people. Nothing was there. He kicked it over to Butler on the right side, and they went right into a two-man game with Harris. Butler pitched to Harris. It ended up being a kind of a pick and roll. Harris gets in the lane, has momentum, draws help, dumps it to Simmons in the dunker spot, who lays it up in. And you watch that, and you're like, that's what it is. Right. That's how it works. Who's going to guard that? Those five really good players just did some, all did stuff on one play. You know, their problem is they're in they're in experimental mode. Mm-hmm. You saw it last night. You know, Boban can't play against Boston. They learned that lesson the hard way. I think they're going to continue. Like, they had some minutes where Redick played without Embiid, like extended minutes last night. That's not usual. That makes me think they're sniffing around with, do we still, I think they're going to sniff around some things like, do we still stagger Ben and Joel hardcore? Or because we have these two other star-ish players, can we try to maximize the Ben Joel minutes together because we have other guys that can carry us? And that, you know, they only got 20 games to screw around with this.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. There's the trade raised the ceiling, or the two trades, because we still have to remember that, you know, it's still pretty early in the Jimmy Butler experience too. You know, there's a lot of, the ceiling has been raised significantly, but there's still a lot of kind of chemistry stuff to figure out, the experiment. There's still a lot to figure out. I also really loved after the game, apparently Brett Brown said that there's a quiet tournament going on to determine whether Jonathan Simmons, Korkmaz, or James Ennis is going to get the minutes, and one of them will win the quiet tournament. I was like, that sounds like a really weird thing.
Nobody's watching that tournament.
No.
It's not a popular tournament. They need, you know who needs to win that tournament for them is player X, who's not on the team yet,
needs
to be the winner of that tournament. I'm just interested, like, how many minutes can you play a lineup? Like, if you look at the most played lineups in the league, it's like the Pacers starting five, the Thunder starting five. They average like 18 minutes a game. I wonder how far you can stretch a five-man lineup. Because they can do lots of other combinations, but I that group I really, really like, and I think it's a problem. It's clearly a matchup problem. It's designed to be a matchup problem because there's going to be, you know, cross matches all over the floor. And every time they come down the floor, they are going to have a mismatch somewhere of varying degree. Not every time, but a lot of times because of just the weirdness of Ben Simmons and the weirdness of their lineup. And that's one of the reasons I like everyone's been fretting about ever since Simmons collapsed against Boston about can they win against an elite defense when the game slows down. Now, maybe the question is, can they win against Boston when the game slows down? Because Boston has Horford and Morris and all these guys who are ideally suited to play Simmons and Embiid. But one of the ways you can win when the game slows down is to make the game really, really simple. And just say, who's bigger than the other guy?
Right.
Give that guy the ball. And they can do that at four different positions now. That's interesting to me. Like, it doesn't matter as much if Ben's, it still matters, but it doesn't matter if Ben Simmons is hanging out on the baseline and can't shoot. If all you're doing is asking someone else to mow somebody over, like, that's feasible.
I agree with you. I think that's sort of what leads to Boston's most interesting question with some of that stuff too, is because the size advantages didn't seem as pronounced for Philly when it's Smart in the backcourt, when it's, you know, they're playing Smart and Brown and Tatum and Morris and Horford. You know, the size advantages are still there, but they don't seem as pronounced and there's no one to hunt. And so then that brings the big question of like, obviously the Celtics are not better without Kyrie, but are they a better matchup for Philly? Or are they a tougher matchup for Philly to figure out when, as you said, you know, it's not who's Kyrie going to guard and where is he going to chase around Redick for 35 possessions or 40 possessions?
Because that's
a
nightmare, by the way. People don't think people actually think that, you know, people realize that guarding JJ is a nightmare. It's a complete nightmare.
And Marcus Smart completely sold out to do it. And when Jaylen Brown had the job for, I think it was about maybe 10 or 11 possessions, whatever it was, sold out to do it. And those guys are big and long and they don't get screened as well. So, I mean, it's as we were talking about earlier, the takey version of that is like, I don't know, maybe the Celtics are better without Kyrie in that matchup. And I think that's crazy. But also, I think it still creates another problem for Philly to have to solve when he's not around. And I do wonder if to some degree Philly's, they would look at that and say, like, we think we got a better shot of hunting those mismatches, creating those cross matches, wreaking havoc. Even if the best offensive player they got is on the floor.
It's a fascinating matchup, and Philly is just sort of figuring lots of stuff out as we talked about. You know, that I like the lineup they've used with McConnell and the other four starters, but not Simmons, so that they separate McConnell and Simmons and put him around max talent. I think Harris is just one of the most fittable guys in the league. You know, he's another guy who can push off rebounds. He's another pick and roll ball handler. He just sort of finds ways to fit in the offense. I think I kind of admired the boldness of what they did, and that lineup scares me. You know, it just picking one of these teams is impossible. How about this? Tell me why it's not Milwaukee. They've been the best team in the league, non-Warriors. They've actually been better than the Warriors, but let's just put the Warriors aside. They've been the other best team in the league all year.
I think it means you have to believe that you're not going to get a repeat of what Eric Bledsoe did in the playoffs last year, right? It's like you haven't matchup-proofed yourself totally there, because I don't think you believe, or maybe you do, I don't know. George Hill, I don't think, is scaring people at that spot in the playoffs, if that's what comes to. I'm not sure that people think that, you know, if you had to minimize, I mean, because Bledsoe's been important for them this season. So if he's playing a more minimized role and you're asking more like ball handling and creating from Brogdon, like I think that's the spot that you would raise questions. And maybe the answer to that, to some degree, I was talking about earlier, Mirotić kind of solving some problems for them. Maybe it's that you kind of play huge and then Giannis takes on more of the primary ball handling role in there, and you don't have to worry about Bledsoe as much because you're playing, you know, Middleton and Brogdon as your backcourt. I think that's sort of the shaky spot. But if that's your shakiest spot right now, that's not a bad place to be living in that matchup.
Bledsoe has been so good this year that I'm just hard pressed to believe the answer will be less Bledsoe. He's been so good, on both ends of the floor. I love the Bucks. I understand why people are a little bit skeptical of the Bucks. They're a team that's built on fit. Their second best player is not as good as the second best player on a typical finals team. Mm-hmm.
I think the other side of it is maybe the Brook Lopez defensive question of they've built a really, really great defense by parking him at the rim, having him be giant and saying, we're going to funnel everything at you. And then you run into those same pick and pop questions. If, you know, say you're dealing with,
Horford
or Marc Gasol, even Ibaka to some degree in that situation. You know, there are these questions that those offenses can ask. But I think, that would sort of be the holes you would poke in their case, but it's a pretty damn strong case.
I'm just not sure how you guard their team. I don't know what the answer is other than have someone who can at least, we've been saying this about LeBron for 15 years, someone who can at least make him work for it, whoever that is, whatever that means, because he has the entire court and he just drives until his arms can reach the bucket and he dunks and that's it. And if you send help, that means somebody's open for three. It's unbelievably simple. Their defense is fascinating. They're number one in defense. They are last in threes allowed. Yep. They allow the most threes in the whole league. And that just seems like it should be fundamentally antithetical to being the best defense.
Like
and
impossible.
And yet it's not. And it's not because they're number one by far in least shots at the rim. They're number one in not fouling. They're number one in transition defense. And despite allowing all those threes, they're still... They allow so few shots at the rim that they're still allowing like the fifth most mid-range jumpers in the whole league. And if you look at our second spectrum stuff, we have this fancy thing that's like, what would the average team shoot against your defense based on where the shots are coming from? They're number two in the whole league in expected field goal percentage against effective field goal percentage. So factoring in threes, despite allowing all those threes. They've figured out something, whatever mathematical trade-off they're working is good. It's working for them. And part of it is that not as many of the threes they're allowing are corner threes. There are a lot of above the break threes. And I just think it's interesting. If you look at teams that allow the most threes as a portion of their shot attempts, Milwaukee, Boston, and Indiana are like three of the top six teams in the whole league, and there's a three of the top four defenses in the league. Stan Van Gundy pointed this out to me a couple months ago and said, I'm telling you right now, I'm analytics friendly. Like analytics. Sometimes get a little cranky about it, but I like it. Not going to do a Stan voice. but you guys are going a little overboard by looking at threes allowed as a de facto measure of defensive quality, because look at all those teams who allow a lot of threes. The rim is more important than threes. And if you build your defense correctly, you can allow more of the longer threes and contest them better. and shut down the rim, and that's better. Then, you know, we lionize all these money ball teams like Utah and Brooklyn who just, you know, we're not allowing threes. Mm-hmm. And some of those teams have centers that allow you to not allow stuff at the rim too, like Gobert. But I think his point is really interesting and Milwaukee is living it right now.
Yeah, it's been, you know, the fact of their length at almost every position that they're huge too. You know, even, you know, Bledsoe not being a big point guard, but being a long and athletic point guard who is able to recover back out to the line. They do, you know, the contesting of those shots and making it more difficult on guys to just raise up and fire on those is a huge part of that too. I mean, it's been, I think all of us expected, you know, I know like, you and Kevin Arnovitz have talked about this a few times, that idea of like systematizing Milwaukee. Like, what would that team look like if there was this sort of firm scheme? We all expected a bump. I know there are other people who were much more bullish on them. The size of the leap on both sides with the systems that they've put into place has been, you know, staggering to me. They've been absolutely fantastic. I only feel badly. Like, I was talking to a Bucks fan on Twitter recently that was like, kind of wondering why I have not written more frequently about them. And I was like, I think it's because I haven't really had a new thought on them since they waxed Golden State in Oracle. And I was like, oh, that's one of the two or three best teams in the league. I don't know that I have a whole lot of new takes on them, because I was like, that's basically a contender fully formed about 6 weeks into the season. And they've been nothing but that over the course of the next few months.
And for all the concern about, you know, Brook Lopez and the, you know, pick and pop threes and all that, he's a strong post defender. Like, Embiid is going to have to get by guys that he can't just dominate by sheer mm-hmm. size. And, you know, whether it's Gasol, Lopez, Horford, who he's much bigger than, but just gives him so many problems. That makes me worry a little bit about Philly, but their sheer accumulation of talent. If you had forced me last Friday, the day after the trade deadline, to rank these four teams in order, I would have gone Milwaukee 1. I might have gone Philly 2. Because mm-hmm. I'm generally a Philly optimist. Even before they got Harris, I was generally optimistic about their team compared to the consensus, who's just waiting for them to break up already.
Right.
Toronto 3. Could flip-flop Philly and Toronto. Something about Toronto, it just doesn't quite feel right to me. Feels a little...
Well, they're the ultimate, it's the Lucy and the football, right? Like, I'm gonna have to, at this point, I feel like I have to see it to believe it.
See, it's not even that for me, because they changed their team so radically by getting a clear top 10 player that and LeBron is gone. So that's so far in the past. It's just the Kawhi thing and the fear, the constant fear hovering over them. Mm-hmm. Now they can project confidence wherever they want. They're scared. And I just think that has to take a psychic cost on your team. And there's something there that I don't quite trust. Very good team. Wouldn't surprise me at all if they made the finals. I would not pick them right now. And I would have put Boston 4. Mm-hmm. Because it's been well chronicled. Their season has been strange. And I do feel like they're the team that when I watch them win a game like last night, and remember the overtime win at home against Toronto earlier in the season?
Mm-hmm.
I just watch those games and I'm like, man, they care so much about this game
right.
in February or November. And they're playing with such urgency. I just feel like that urgency gap is going to close in the playoffs, and their effort points, the points they, the effort advantage is going to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me a little nervous about them. That's what I meant. Like last Friday, I said that I feel like they have the lowest ceiling of these four teams. That's kind of what I mean. Like, they have to play really hard to hit that ceiling. Maybe that means they have the lowest floor, whatever the floor ceiling terminology is.
Right.
There's something about them that feels almost too, like, effort dependent. That's not the right way to put it. I'm not putting it well. I don't know. But now I don't know. Now I just, I would still put Milwaukee 1. I think Milwaukee is the best team.
I think they've earned that at this point. Yeah. I mean, I don't see a way that you can look at what they do on either end of the floor and the depth of that rotation and just the, like, you know, almost literally unprecedented production and style of accumulating it that Giannis is putting together, where it's like a prime Kareem season arrived at via young Shaq. Like, what, you know, what the heck do you even do with that? And the answer is, like, no one seems to really know what the heck you do with that.
Well, and he's shooting well from three lately.
It's actually started to pick up, right?
Which we're a year away from this becoming a thing. Like, I find a hard time to believe he's now going to suddenly hit 35% of his threes on three or four a game. But if and when he reaches that point, he's going to win multiple MVPs. If he might win it this year anyway.
Right.
But if he becomes an average 3-point shooter on average volume, it's all over. Like, you just hand him the trophy a couple of times. There's more to talk about in the East, but we're going to have all year to talk about this. Listeners, hiring, I can imagine, is one of those things that can be challenging and time consuming. There are hundreds of job boards. Do you have to post your ad on every one? How do you know that you're not missing the one job board that has the right person? But there's one place where you can go that makes it simple, fast, and smart, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, the name of this podcast. ZipRecruiter sends your job automatically to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't even stop there. They have powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes and proactively finds people with the right experience, and then double proactively invites them to apply to your job. You've done nothing except use ZipRecruiter. Bam, they've found people for you. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers, that's a lot. If you shoot 80% from the foul line, that's pretty good. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. You pretty much can't do any better than that. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free, zero, nothing, at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. The name of this podcast, LOWEPOST, that's ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. The bottom of the East is, like, unbelievably depressing. I mean, Miami's in a world of hurt. Andre Drummond has picked up his play. I got to give him credit. I hammered Andre Drummond a couple weeks ago. He's played very well. He's played very well the last couple weeks. He's picked it up. He's playing with as hard as he needs to play and grabbing every rebound and doing what he needs to do. So credit to him. My favorite tweet of the year, my favorite tweet of last season was Orlando tweeting out that Shelvin Mack was its assist leader.
It was legendary. It was an iconic tweet by the Orlando Magic.
Three assists a game, I think it was.
Something like that, like 3.5 or something like that, yeah.
The Magic beat Atlanta the other night to improve to 25-32. Kem Birch tweeted out, playoff run, exclamation point. And I'm like, listen, they've won four in a row. It's very exciting. They were 25-32. At that time in the West, they would have been 13th. And we'll see how the East standings shake up. Like, it's not like the Lakers are lighting the world on fire, where if LeBron misses the playoffs and they play like this, you're going to be like, well, they really deserved it. You know, it's not fair. But boy, just when a 25-32 team is gearing up for a playoff run, and you have the Clippers are 31-27, and that 25-32 team would be 13th. I get the travel concerns. I get it. I get that they don't want a Miami-Portland series in the first round and then a Miami-Golden State series in the second round, and it's not fair to the coastal teams.
Mm-hmm.
Every year I get a little less convinced that we need to have the top eight from each conference in.
Especially when, I mean, there's been research on that about what a 2-3-2, shifting back to a 2-3-2 would do to alleviate the travel concerns and the way that could work with scheduling. And yeah, there are competing sort of factors there for sure. But I mean, listen, as I think we can all agree that we're going to be bouncing our grandkids on their knees talking about the time that Kem Birch sparked a playoff
run, Orlando. Baby. We're 7 games under. We're 7 games under. Isaiah Briscoe is our new backup point guard because Jerry and Grant was so bad.
Jerry and Grant, listen, once a Nick, always a Nick. Let's.
I forget that Jerry. Sometimes people tweet the once a Nick, always a Nick acronym. I'm like, man, I forgot that dude was a Nick.
Right. It's also, it's sort of perfect because it's like, what is it? Like, Oak. It is like the most unwieldy, gross, weird looking.
But it starts with Oak, which is always great. Tips me off that it's something about the Knicks.
And also, how wonderfully poison is that? That, like, given the way everything went with Charles Oakley at the Garden and with the Knicks, that
did the Knicks really ban Bondi from the Daily News?
What I heard was that that there was a maybe ban is perhaps too strong a word, but we don't maybe have to let everybody in on the phone call. We don't have to let everybody in on the presser.
Adam Pally, friend of the program. He tweeted this the other day, and we've been emailing about it. He got, as he called it, Ethan Hawked, where he somewhere made some comments about Dolan and was then told he can't get tickets to games anymore.
Who would not want to join this organization, Zach, I ask you?
Well, that's what I want. I can't have you on.
Oh, no.
It's been a couple weeks now. We've all had time to digest it. You wrote your lament. Nobody writes laments like Knick fans. Just nobody writes.
We have a lot of practice.
I like how someone was like, this stat has been going around now that the Knicks have not signed one of their first round draft picks to a second contract since Charlie Ward.
Yeah, I think that's our friend Jared Dubin had that.
In this millennia or century or whatever the right thing is. And you want to say, it hasn't been the 2000s that long. You're like, actually, it's been 20 years. It's been 20 years. It's been 20 drafts.
They drafted him in 94, and he's the last guy they re-upped on a second deal. So is the question, how am I doing after the Porzingis trade?
Have you come around on the Porzingis trade?
Not to make myself sound like more of a smart and refined person as than I am, because I certainly don't deserve that, but I feel like I'm processing it on two levels.
Okay.
So there's the logical reason of this is someone who's missed a ton of time over the past 3 years, is coming back from an injury. We have no idea really what he's going to look like when he comes back from it. And there are questions about whether he wants to be there at all. There's questions about what level of superstar he maybe really is based on the way that his production sort of starts off and tails off over the course of his time. There are these questions, and then you say, well, if that's what the price of clearing out these whatever $74 million in cap space and clearing the deck so that you have the way to move into a new sort of future under this new for this front office, I can get the idea of adding picks as opposed to giving them away and clearing the decks and all that sort of stuff. So the logic of it, when people argue this is why the move made sense, I understand the logic. The logic is not lost on me. Then there's the part of me that, and we've talked about this before, you know, there's that sense of, you do this for a long enough time and you stop being as rabid as you once were. I'm definitely not as rabid a Knicks fan as I once was, but I've never been able to get where you got, where it just goes away. And this was really what reminded me of that. Like, this is the first guy that I got to root for as a Knicks fan where it was like, this might be the guy. This might be the guy for the first time since Patrick Ewing. In a way that's different than Carmelo or different from Amari, because while those guys chose here or forced their way here or whatever, this is the guy who would be the homegrown talent. And so, I think even if this winds up being right, and it could wind up being very right, it's always going to feel a little bit wrong to me, I think.
I talked about it last week. I don't want to belabor it. I think it's one of the more interesting trades we've had in the last 10 or 15 years, just in terms of, you know, the Knicks had one max slot sitting there for them. They would have had to get off Courtney Lee. So that's one pick out the window to get off Courtney Lee.
Right.
So now they've net gained three picks by doing this trade and a second max slot, but lost Porzingis.
Right.
So Porzingis plus one max with one pick out the door versus two maxes for zero players yet with three picks in the door. Which is better? You better get that second max. Well, that second max better mean something because you traded a really good player.
That's the thing. You know, I mean, I think that there's... It's, you know, our friend Jason Concepcion talks about this, like, you better really hope there's tampering going on in this case, because if you're talking about a coin flip shot at two of those max guys and a 14% chance at Zion or a whatever lower percentage chance it is that you're able to flip that or flip whatever your lottery pick winds up as for another star, there's something that's so quintessentially Knicks-y about the idea of like, yeah, okay, so we're the worst team in the league by a pretty considerable amount right now. But if everything goes right, we're going to be building for the next 5 years around Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and either Zion Williamson or Anthony Davis. Who's with me? Who's in? And that idea that everyone's like, oh, I'm totally in. Oh, I have to disregard the notion that any of this, all of the things that would be reasons why people wouldn't want to be here, would be reasons why people wouldn't want to be here. I have to move away from the notion that, you know, both Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving seem awfully tetchy about the idea of being associated with this at this point. You know, rumbling about, people, you know, that their decisions aren't their own or that somebody else's decision is, impacting theirs or whatever.
I'm glad you brought that up. The KD thing was very strange. Because, you know, Ethan Strauss is a friend of mine. He's come on this show before.
Sure.
I read that story, and I thought, well written, like everything Ethan does. Beautifully written, actually. Envious. I'm envious. I didn't think anything in there was, like, revelatory.
Or inflammatory.
Really. I just thought, this is a person who's around the team. Kevin Durant hasn't talked in 8 days. Something's wrong. Everyone thinks he's going to the Knicks. Like, I don't know why that story struck. Maybe it was the timing of it after Porzingis and after he's gone silent. But that story just sort of like, lots of us have been saying Knicks stuff for a long time. It was very strange that he got so angry about that.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that sort of made sense to me about it was this, that it was, I don't know, like impinging on his ability to control what the messaging was, or that he just didn't feel like, you know, the idea that I don't have to explain myself to you guys. I don't have to explain myself to anybody about this. Nothing in there struck me as like, it was a story more about, yes, he holds all the cards, but the people around him are concerned about this, or at least have questions about it, which I don't think anything about that was something that's different than anything we talked about since whatever the Draymond blow up or any of those things.
My crazy prediction before the season was KD signed with the Knicks.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a topic, you know, discussed in sort of whispers and shouts for months.
You didn't yell at me.
Well, give it time.
It was very weird. The Knicks. A 17-game losing streak has seldom gone under the radar like the current 17-game losing streak, and the unicornette could not quite bring it to an end in Cleveland the other night. Yeah, it's a miserable team to watch. Absolutely miserable. And if they're really banning people from press conferences, it's like, well, you've lost 17 games in a row. Okay, you're lucky anyone is going to
You should
games.
Be excited.
You're lucky anyone wants to talk about Noah Vonleh's postgame, because nobody freaking cares. You know, Frank Ntilikina is still hurt. Like, there's no reason. Dennis Smith is the most exciting reason to watch the team. I like Dennis Smith. He's all right. He's a good prospect. Do you have any rituals for watching the lottery?
No. Well, especially because the last few years when I was working at my previous employer.
Yeah, you have to.
I would have to write it. It was more, my ritual was basically like pausing and writing, and then getting something up 35 seconds afterward. But do you think I should get some, like, vote of candles or?
No, I don't know what works.
I've got
this is the one for you.
I've got an underground poster of Starks doing the dunk over the TV. So maybe we'll just like throw some candles around there. We'll see about that.
I mean, this is the one that you got to be nervous for, even though it's just the way your brain works. 14% feels like a lot when it's sitting right in front of you, when you know it's right there. 14% is not a lot.
Yeah.
Knicks fans should prepare to not get Zion Williamson. That should be your default assumption, is you get one of these other dudes.
Unless we get Zion Williamson.
Unless you get Zion. Yeah. I think if you have to go through you have the three worst teams get the
14%. Yeah, that flatten out.
So right now there are four teams in contention for that. Okay. We can't give it to Cleveland. We just can't. They won too many lotteries. They should be disqualified. Chicago. Their fans hate their own team, so I don't think you can give it to Chicago. If your fans are like, we should just burn the whole thing down, I don't think you can introduce Zion into that environment. They don't deserve it. Phoenix, can we give Robert Sarver the number one pick in the draft? They just had it last year, and they're no. So you could argue. Now, why should the Knicks deserve it, though? The Knicks are
If we're invoking the Robert Sarver, Dan Gilbert, etc.
No, none
clauses,
of these people deserve it. You know who should get the number one pick? Who should get? Let me just think. Who's going to be in the lottery that really should get the number one pick? Minnesota just got it with they have two number one picks on their roster. The Pelicans will be a sympathetic choice. No to the Pelicans. Imagine if the Lakers missed the playoffs and got it. I think the Memphis Grizzlies should get the number one pick. How about that? Memphis.
I'm here for it. If you're ever going to have that situation where, like, they don't roll over their pick, they're not bad enough or whatever, or they're not good enough to give it to Boston now, I mean, I think the idea of giving up an unprotected one in 2 years would be softened by getting Zion this year.
You know who else should get it? Here should get the number one picks.
Power rankings.
Memphis is in there. Orlando. I'm weird. I just am obsessed with the Magic. I just think they're the weirdest franchise. No one pays any attention to them. No one has any idea what's going on with the Magic. There's like seven people outside Orlando who can name more than two players on the Magic. Right. They're super big. They're long. Now they have Markelle Fultz. It's just so weird. And they go down, and ever since they won the Shaq Penny ones, they go down every year.
Right.
So they're in my spot.
You want a fun one?
Don't say the Wizards.
The Atlanta Hawks.
Yeah, they're in my top five. Sure. The Hawks are fun.
I obviously have a preference for how I would like things to shake out, but the idea of Zion with Trae Young, Herter, that sort of young John Collins, that's a pretty good team pretty quick, I think. But actually, you know what? Can we just delete that all out? Forget that. The only acceptable answer
is the Knicks.
Is the Knicks.
You want to see James Dolan smiling, slouching in his chair and smiling.
If I could, that's a real, you know, devil's advocate or Sophie's choice kind of thing of like, if they don't get Zion, but it means that there's no smiles for James Dolan ever again, that's tough.
I think here's the best case scenario. Well, actually, you know, I'll tell you what the best case scenario is. The best case scenario is the craziest case scenario. Is the Kings miss the playoffs, win the lottery, and the Sixers get their pick at number one. At first, I swear to God, Kings fans, at first I was going to say the most fun team to win the lottery would be to give Fox and Hield and Giles and Bagley, who are in my 10 things on Friday, another stud, and just here's a Kings dynasty for the next 10 years. And as I got ready to say that, I remembered, uh-oh, they owe that pick. They owe that pick, and if it's number one, it goes to Philly. Imagine if Philly had the number one pick. That's the craziest scenario. Yeah. So I'm rooting for that. I think the lottery should be whatever the most ridiculous thing is, that's what I want to happen.
I think that's a really totally reasonable way to look at it if you're not hoping for Zion Williamson to land in the Knicks, on the Knicks.
As a New Yorker, I should be hoping for the Knicks to get
it. Yeah, just an easy train ride.
I guess that would be fun. It just feels like they don't deserve to be a super team next year.
Well, and that's sort of the main thing, right? Like all of this, we're going to clear out the cap space. We have the plan 3 steps ahead. It all is contingent on these superstars who have their own decision making apparatuses around them, yeah. And their sort of sense of the power that they wield and how they should wield it, and you know what they should be able to do with it. All of that being like the organization that's the best fit for me to do that or to control that or whatever is the Knicks. Like what over the last 20 years would give you the indication that that's a fertile ground for you, you know, expanding your brand or building your legacy or whatever. And I understand the argument of if you win in New York, you're a legend forever, but like.
So you don't even have to win at this point. If you can just have a year like Carmelo had in 2013 when they won 54 games, if you can have that year 3 times in a row, then it's the same as winning a championship. They've been so bad for so long that if you can just do that a few times, you're
good money.
You're Mark Messier. You don't even have to win.
This is how far back you've got to go for those sorts of things to be like Messier in 94, man. Like that's for Garden, consistent contingent Garden success. It's like, it's got to be Mark Messier guaranteeing it.
Weren't the Rangers good with this Lundqvist guy a few years
ago? They were good.
Ago?
But I guess never that good.
Okay.
Hockey fell away for me when I started doing this as a job.
Yeah, I don't have any.
The seasons run concurrently and I don't have that much time.
I was a big Andy Moog fan. As a kid.
A lot to like about Andy Moog.
That's my lottery hope. I really just hope. None of these teams get me that excited. It just can't be the Bulls. Their own fans want to immolate the entire arena. It can't be them.
I will say, as a Knicks fan who has read a fair amount of other Knicks fans, rending of garments and gnashing of teeth, I enjoy very little more than reading Bulls fans do that. It reaches another level, I think, even than Knicks fans can get to. So, like the people at Bloggable and the different sort of, Ricky O'Donnell at SB Nation, some of the higher end Bulls fans that do that kind of work it's always an enjoyable. I mean, there's a little bit of Schadenfreude to it, but there's also a little bit of like recognizing your tribe.
Who's your MVP right now? How about I spring that one on you right at the end here?
That's fine. Whatever we can do as a ruthless plug. There might be Paul George, who I wrote about yesterday at TheRinger.com, who has been absolutely sensational. The numbers over the last two, since the beginning of January, it is something sort of a little bit, but then you see it laid out in front of you and it blows your mind. The production, just points, rebounds, assists since January 1st, I think, is right around in line with what Durant did in his MVP season. The shooting, 45.4% from three on around 11 a game, is right in line with what Steph did in his unanimous season. And then he's also a finalist, maybe, for caliber for Defensive Player of the Year. And you're like, that guy might be the third guy on the ballot. You know, it's been sensational to see that sort of unfold. If I had a ballot, I don't. And if I was going to get one, I might go with, I mean, there's that, you know, it's kind of hard to go wrong with best player on the best team. So if the idea of going Giannis, appeals to me there, but, also really hard to argue with Harden doing, what is it, like the seventh highest scoring in NBA history right now?
It's pretty crazy.
It's nuts. So, I probably would go Giannis if I had a pick right now, but, you know, ask me in 2 weeks, the weather might change.
I don't know who I'll vote for, but I do think it's a three-man race. Paul George is a real candidate. I did a whole podcast yesterday with Tim McMahon about this. It's going to be heated. It's going to be heated like it was 2 years ago.
Because all those teams are fighting for something, too, down the stretch.
And you put it, I said this to him yesterday, Paul George has become Kevin Durant. Paul George is what Kevin Durant was with Russ in Oklahoma City.
Which is nuts. I mean, even those of us who loved what Paul George could do, I don't know that anyone, or I shouldn't say that. That's maybe not fair. I didn't think his ceiling was that. And no. He's playing at the top of it right now.
He is not going to play like this all year. And to your point, to that point, he's shooting 50% on tightly contested threes.
Just bonkers.
It's the best in the league by far. Like, that's obviously not going to happen. And he's not Kevin Durant in the sense that you can't throw him the ball in the post and expect the same quality of shot because he's not 7 feet tall. But by a lot of numbers, and I'm not going to repeat what I said yesterday, he has essentially become what Kevin Durant was in 2016, his last year with the Thunder, which is unbelievable. And I've always said Paul George is a boss. Paul George is unbelievable, but like, I didn't even see this coming. I did not see he's in the MVP conversation period coming.
Yeah, it's been pretty insane to watch. And then also, like, you have to give it up to some degree for Westbrook as well. I mean, being willing to take a step back on the usage, even if the true shooting percentage is gross, like, the defensive work is there, or it's better, and the facilitating is better. All those things create the room for that. And if he doesn't decide he's open to doing that and give Paul George a space to do it, you know, who knows if you get this much out of Paul George. So, I know we catch a fair amount of flack at the Ringer for Westbrook related takes, but I think he deserves a fair amount of respect for what he's done. It would just be nice if he hits some shots.
And hey, look, I didn't vote Westbrook MVP. I'm not proud of that vote. I'm happy with that vote in retrospect. I'm happy with it. I think I made the choice that feels good to me.
Right.
You know, I had Arnovitz on this podcast picking our all-star teams, and I saw who the other various analysts who picked the teams picked. A lot of them didn't pick Westbrook. I picked Westbrook.
Mm-hmm.
I picked Westbrook because you just can't find people who put that kind of pressure on the rim.
Right.
Even if he is 5-for-21, he is such a force of nature and such a physical, spiritual, attacking force against your defense all the time that, A, he makes life easier for all, including Paul George, for all these other guys besides Paul George who need to be spoon-fed. He spoon-feeds them. And, B, there is just an emotional cost of, he's coming again, my God. He's coming. I got to deal with him. Oh, God, we just turned it over. Oh, my God, he's coming again. It just, like, even when he's 5-for-19, the impact on your defense, on your game planning, on your mental and physical fatigue is incalculable. And the effort plays he makes, the offensive rebounds to extend possessions, as much as you want to make fun, and I've made fun of his defensive rebounding, and how Steven Adams, indestructible force of nature Steven Adams, has essentially the same career defensive rebounding rate as Andrea Bargnani, the worst rebounding seven-footer in the history of Earth. Okay, you can look it up. It's true. Because he just says, I don't care about getting it. Steven Adams might be the MVP of the Thunder. Because all these dudes want to come back to play. Who wouldn't want to play with that guy?
He's like the giving tree with a bunch of tattoos.
You guys want some rebounds? I'll just box out four people. You guys want me to just like kind of instigate fights and because I can't get hurt, so I'll just elbow people until they get ejected from the game. I'll finish all your passes because I'm super skilled. Who wouldn't want to play with Steven Adams?
It makes it a lot easier for everybody.
But
for sure.
But his rebounding is real. It's like 90% real.
Mm-hmm.
Westbrook's rebound is like 90% real. 10% is like fake free throw rebounds and all that. But just the momentum changing nature of it's all, as much as I was a non-MVP voter and as much as I've pointed out his bad shooting, he's had in his own way a very good season.
That's bringing it back around to just that top of the East. I think that maybe that's where you land on some of these questions of like, who's that guy who is just going to be putting that pressure on the opponent every single possession in that way? And I feel like if that's going to be part of your rubric for decision making on this, like, I feel like the answer to that is probably most likely to be either Giannis or Kawhi. The guy who, like, when you're like, man, here he comes again. That feels like those are the answers there, because maybe it's Embiid, but if you frustrate Embiid enough inside, all those jumpers start to come, and they're not as valuable as you need to. You can stop Simmons from getting to the rim if you really commit to it. Kyrie is a wizard and can get there on his own, but it's different force than you have with a guy like Giannis or Kawhi. So if it breaks down to that, who is the guy that you just have to, you relentlessly have to deal with every single possession? Those might be the two teams that have the answer. The other guys don't.
Yeah. And like, you know, people want to reduce basketball to, can he be the best player on a championship team? And, you know, it's been written about and talked about how, I don't think the Warriors are deathly afraid of Russ in the way that I just talked about. I don't think, and there are many people in the league who, for them, the answer is no, you can't win a championship with Russ as the best player on the team. He took 43 shots in game 7 against Utah, blah, 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 blah. He's not the best player on his team this season.
Mm-hmm.
And B, that question just drives me crazy, because who's been the best player on the championship team in the last 10 years? It's like you're essentially just saying, are you one of the top three players in the league?
Right.
It's an unfair standard. If you want to compete every night and build a team that can win a championship, he can be on your team, and he can be 1B on your team, if not co-1A, something like that. Anyway, that's enough of my Rush spiel. I still don't think he should have won the MVP. Dan Devine, read him at The Ringer. Everything he writes is great. He's writing a lot. Really kind of writes a lot, and it's all good somehow. I don't know how that is, but I'm glad The Ringer is working out for you. Say hi to all my buddies over there, and I don't know, light some incense, get something ready for May, whatever. The lottery's like 3 months away.
I will do, Zach. Thank you very much for having me back.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.